And the New York Times, they are afraid of him. But what amazes me about you, Noam, is your profound humanity and your identification with the human race. The Talmud has a phrase for you and for many who have labored long and hard in the field. Do not be daunted by the enormity of the world's grief. Do justly now. Love mercy now. Walk humbly now. You're not obligated to complete the work, but neither are you free to abandon it. Help me to welcome Noam Chomsky.
Well, I know we don't have a lot of time, and I'm sure, without even asking, that you have plenty of things on your mind that you'd like to talk about. So I don't want to monopolize this. I'm going to say a few things and then basically turn it over to you, and I hope we can go on with the discussion, much more interesting for everybody. Just a side comment after what Blaise said. Don't feel intimidated about not having taken a graduate course in linguistics. There's nothing that I'm going to talk about or that I know about or that's relevant to these things that's beyond the level of an ordinary high school student. My grandchildren don't have much trouble with them without any advanced degrees. What's understood is pretty much on the surface. And you're kind of, people are intimidated into believing that they can't understand, and that's part of the system of indoctrination that you ought to escape from. We're all aware that right at this moment, bodies are being mutilated and torn to shreds by infernal weapons. Unknown numbers of people, hundreds of thousands, maybe millions, are facing the threat of starvation and slow death. They were at the edge of survival after a decade of sanctions, criminal sanctions, even before the attack started, and no one knows what the effect will be. Could be grim. Under circumstances like that, it is not easy for any of us, I'm sure, to try to step back and take a cooler look and ask how we got to this situation, where it's likely to go from here, and what we can do about it. But that's what I'll try to do, putting aside the scenes of horror that are all in the back of all our minds. With regard to the last question, what can we do? The answer is not just a lot, but virtually everything. We're unusually privileged. We're, by comparative standards, most of us remarkably have resources available to us that others don't have. We have enormous freedom. That's not a gift that was given to us. It's a legacy that was left to us by centuries of struggle, by centuries of people, most of whose names are completely forgotten, but who were the important people and the ones who created the freedom and the rights that we now have, and that will be taken away unless you constantly defend them. There is, in fact, a major effort to take them away right now. They will be, unless they're defended, they can be extended, and they should go far beyond the changes. Even in recent years, there's been very striking and dramatic progress, there can be a lot more. With regard to the current situation, we can do more to change it than anyone in the world. All of this should be truism. It's also kind of a truism that privilege confers responsibility. At that point, choices arise. You can face the responsibility, which may not be easy, but it's a lot easier for us than people in almost all the world. Or you can shirk the responsibility, and in which case you're leaving the future to be determined by forces that are anything but benign. And it's not an exaggeration to say that that future may not be very long. They're pushing to the edge of survival. It's not an exaggeration. There have been crises in the past. The scale is quite different. Most of the people in the world, in fact, I'm sure the overwhelming majority, are praying that we will take that responsibility. There is just no other way, in the near future at least, to put a halt to a juggernaut that is regarded around the world with great fear and dread and often hatred. In fact, I can't remember a moment like this in history. Just see if you can think of one. I can't. When one great power with enormous means of violence at its hands was so hated and despised and feared. The war that's going on is called in the propaganda system the War of the Allies. The only thing they're allied, the only alliance is the alliance of Bush and Blair against literally the entire world. The world opinion is overwhelmingly opposed to the war. It's not just the war. It's opposed to what the war is. The war is understood as a symptom of something much broader, and the opposition is to the much broader phenomenon of which this war is just an instance. We know what it is. I mean, at this point, even before the war began, you could read last October in the national press that the world is more concerned about the unbridled use of U.S. power than it is about the threat posed by Saddam Hussein. Opening article in the opening sentences of an article in the Christian Science Monitor last October, which is an understatement, because in fact the world was not concerned about the threat posed by Saddam Hussein because it didn't see any threat. They may hate, even his neighbors despise him, but are not afraid of him. They weren't afraid of him for very good reasons. They know that, as everyone who's paid attention knows, that Iraq was heavily damaged by the first Gulf War, the decade of sanctions, which were a truly criminal act. The UN coordinators were not exaggerating when they called them genocidal, drove the society to the edge of survival. A large majority are on the edge of starvation. Iraq is the weakest country in the region. Its military expenditures and its economy are about a third those of Kuwait. Kuwait has 10% of its population. Far below those of other countries in the region, and not even shouting distance of the regional superpower. The regional superpower is, in effect, an offshore military base of the United States and totally dominates everyone else in the region, namely Israel. That's a small country, but being a U.S. military offshoot, it's extraordinarily powerful. Hundreds of nuclear weapons, according to its own estimate, it has air and armored forces that are larger and technologically more advanced than any NATO power outside the U.S., let alone any country in the region. And people in the region don't have to be told that Iraq is not the, even though Iraq has only partially conformed to a series of U.N. resolutions, there are other countries that have totally rejected many more UN resolutions, Israel's one of them, Turkey's another, Morocco's another, and those are very serious resolutions having to do with aggression, military occupation, violations of the Geneva Agreements, means war crimes in our terms. They know all that. And they also know something else, that the only reason that these countries are not in violation of more UN resolutions, and in fact more serious ones, is that the United States won't permit it. The U.S. vetoes them. The U.S. is far ahead of anyone else since the 1960s in vetoing Security Council resolutions. Britain's second, nobody's within shouting distance. That brings up another point. If Iraq had the veto, how many UN resolutions would it be violating? Well, obvious answer, none. That means if any discussion of violation of Security Council resolutions even pretends to be serious, it's going to bring in the veto. Otherwise, it doesn't even pretend to be serious. You can ask yourself how often this has been brought up in the discussion of passionate discussions of Iraq's only partial compliance with a series of UN Security Resolutions, Council resolutions. And the resolutions that the U.S. has vetoed, and remember, it's far in the lead, nobody's close except Britain, are very serious ones. It includes, for example, several resolutions calling on all states to observe international law, which the United States vetoed with Britain abstaining. It includes resolutions calling on the United States to observe the rulings of the World Court, the International Court of Justice, which condemned the United States for unlawful use of force. That means international terrorism in its war against Nicaragua, which Blaise mentioned. The U.S. simply disregarded it, vetoed the Security Council resolution, and a long series of others on a wide range of issues. These are not trivial matters, and it's not ancient history either. In fact, it's the very same administration which is in office right now. They're almost identical to the ones who ran the country from in the Reagan-Bush administrations. These are serious issues, and the people in the region are well aware of it. They're also well aware that however much they may despise Saddam Hussein, he's not a threat. It's the weakest country in the region and far from the most serious violator of Security Council resolutions. This ought to be, everybody ought to know this. You know, this ought to be the front pages of independent media, if there were any. These are close to truisms. You know, there's nothing obscure about these things. It's the kind of things you ought to learn about in high school, you know. But you certainly ought to think about and find out about. They're important to know. Well, Saddam Hussein is undoubtedly hated and despised in the region. But by now, George Bush has accomplished a miracle. He's not only organized an international peace movement, as Blaise said, he's turned Saddam Hussein into a figure who is revered in the region. It's gotten to the point where the mainstream press is concerned about it. Been major articles in the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, and others in the last couple of days saying that the ones we're claiming to be liberating, the Arab and Muslim worlds, are in a total fury about this. There's a wave of revulsion against the U.S. war, which has extended the fear and hatred of the administration in Washington well beyond what it was before, and have even turned Saddam Hussein into a figure of reverence. I mean, they hate him. They know he's a thug and a despot and a killer. But at least he's standing up to the savage Americans, and he's the only one who's doing it. And you can read in the mainstream press here that he's described with reverence by people in all walks of life in countries like Jordan, you know, the closest ally of the United States, and by people right in the mainstream, you know, Christian, wealthy Christian Arabs who say, okay, America is our enemy, we have to destroy them. Head of the Strategic Studies Center in Jordan, very pro-American, was quoted recently, just a couple days ago, as saying that there is no doubt that in the Arab world, Saddam Hussein holds the high ground. And he was worried about that. because he knows what it means for countries like Jordan and Egypt and others. If they ever relax controls, if they ever allow the voice of the people to be heard, it's going to be the voice of radical Islamists who want to declare global war against the United States, and secular nationalists who are very much into the whole U.S. International economic system, but agree with them. Agree with them that something must be done to stop this savage power, which there. Here we can turn to actual polls. There have been recent polls of the Arab world conducted by specialists at U.S. universities, which show that about 95% of the population from Morocco to through the Persian Gulf to Lebanon believes that the United States has no interest in the Arab world other than controlling its oil, protecting its offshore military base, Israel, and humiliating Arabs and Muslims, doing that by virtue of the fact that it possesses the force, the means of violence, that enable it to do anything it wants, to murder people from a safe distance, to kick them in the face, anything. That doesn't make friends. The Washington Post article about this a couple of days ago opens by saying, things are happening in the Arab, things are brewing in the Arab world, which do not bode well for the United States. That's quite true, that their Bush is acting to create the basis for a reaction which is likely to be a reaction of expanded terrorism. They know they're not going to attack the United States. They can't do that. But they can do what international affairs specialists have been pointing out for a long time. They can develop weapons of mass destruction. They can carry out extensive terrorist acts, which are basically unstoppable. And that's exactly the consequences of the actions that are being taken, quite apart from what's happening to Iraqis and Palestinians and others, which they see, even though they're suppressed here. I mean, if somebody was watching this from outer space, they would be, could be forgiven for believing that George Bush was embedded into the White House, to use a contemporary term, as an agent of Osama bin Laden. I mean, if Osama, it's not a joke. I mean, if Osama's alive, he must be enjoying this mightily. You know, it's fulfilling his wildest dreams. It's creating a war between the evil empire and billions of people around the world who are terrified of it and want to destroy it. Well, you know, how did we get to this point? It was bad enough. It goes back quite a ways, but let's just take the, too much time, just take the very recent past. Let's begin with last September. A lot of things happened last September. One thing that happened last September is that the Bush administration released its national security strategy. That was an extremely important document. It sent shudders around the world and, in fact, right through the U.S. foreign policy establishment, like the next issue of Foreign Affairs, the main establishment journal, had a pretty harsh critique of it. What did it say? Well, it was very brazen. The national security strategy said that the U.S. is intending to, the U.S. government is intending to rule the world by force. That's the dimension in which the U.S. has overwhelming advantages. By now, it probably outspends the rest of the world combined in military force and is expanding it in directions that are considered extraordinarily dangerous by everyone, like moving into weaponry in outer space. It's not dominant in other dimensions, but in force, yes, overwhelmingly dominant. The U.S. intends to rule the world by force and to do it permanently. Any potential challenge that is detected to U.S. dominance will be destroyed. That's the content of the national security strategy. There's been nothing like that in history. Nobody's ever said that. They may think it, you know, or they may describe policy that way, in fact have, but it's never been declared as official government policy before. There are precedents, and they're worth looking at, but nothing quite like this. Frightened people, increased the fear that already existed. The fear was already great, increased it greatly. This is sometimes called a preemptive war doctrine. That's just propaganda. It's not a preemptive war doctrine. Preemptive war means something. A preemptive war, under charitable interpretations, falls within the existing framework of international law. Okay, so those of you whose memories are long enough may remember that the present incumbents in Washington, one of the ways they kept the country terrified through the 1980s, as they did, one of them was to conjure up an air base in Grenada, which the Russians were going to use to bomb us. You know, fortunately, our brave cowboy leader saved us in time, sent 6,000 special forces who managed to overcome the resistance of a couple of dozen Cuban paramilitary workers with pistols, and actually got 8,000 medals of honor for it. And we were standing tall after that, if you remember. So we were saved. But for a while, it looked like the Russians were going to bomb us from Grenada, assuming they could find it on a map somewhere. Well, suppose they found it, and they had bombers there. And the bombers in Grenada were doing just what we were told they were going to do when everyone was supposed to be shivering. They were coming across the Caribbean to bomb Florida. Okay, if at that point the U.S. sent out planes to shoot down the bombers before they destroyed us, that would be legitimate under Article 51 of the UN Charter. That's preemptive war. This is something totally different. This is a doctrine that says we will attack anyone who we regard as a potential challenge. Nothing preemptive about that. Sometimes it's called preventive war, but that's not right either. It's not preventing anything. The only thing it's preventing is any potential challenge that the U.S. government invents, claims to be a challenge. That's just an open license to go to war with anybody and destroy anybody, which we can do because we have overwhelming power. And that's the way it's understood, and that doesn't make people comfortable. It did cause a wave of hatred and fear. This is, I think this is the most feared and hated political leadership maybe in history. It's hard to think of a counterpart. Well, that's one thing that happened in September. Another thing that happened in September is that it was the opening of the midterm election campaign. September was the opening of the campaign for the congressional elections. Well, the Republicans understood very well that they can't possibly win the elections if the issues are those that concern people, socioeconomic issues, basically. And the reason is they're cutting everybody's throat, and they'll get smashed if that's the issue. So they had to do what they did right through the 1980s. Through the 1980s, their policies were extremely unpopular. They were able to stay in for good reason. They were able to stay in office by frightening people, and that's what they did again. Karl Rove just was kind enough yesterday in the New York Times to explain it, although it was obvious before. It was necessary to frighten people into believing that there's a threat to their security. In that case, they'll rally around the strong leader, the brave cowboy, another one. And they'll suppress their concerns over things like, where's my job, or what's happening to my pension, or how am I going to take care of my elderly mother, and so on and so forth. If those issues are, if they're voting on those issues, the administration doesn't have a chance. And as Rove just pointed out yesterday, if they want to pursue their domestic agenda, a very harsh agenda, which would change the, would return the country back to 100 years ago, if they want to do that, they're going to have to frighten people, and that's correct. And they did. Starting in September, there was a drumbeat of propaganda about several things. First, that Saddam Hussein is an imminent threat to our survival, just like Grenada in 1983, an imminent threat to our survival. Another was the constant insinuation that he was behind, he carried out or organized the September 11th attacks, and that they were planning new ones. Well, this was a spectacularly successful government media propaganda campaign. You can see it by looking at the polls. By the end of September and since, around 60% of the population believes that Saddam Hussein is a imminent threat to U.S. security and survival. By now, over a majority think that Iraq was behind September 11th and is planning new things that Iraq